This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Keith Rosenkranz, knows what it's like to fly an F-16 fighter plane in combat missions over Iraq. During the Gulf War of 1991, he flew 30 combat missions over Iraq and Kuwait. He was awarded 4 air medals and 2 aerial achievement medals. He wrote a memoir about his war experiences called Vipers in the Storm. Rosenkranz is a former Air Force captain who is now a pilot for a major commercial airline. I asked him what it's like to watch TV and see soldiers fighting the war in Iraq.
It's very surreal in the sense that I feel like I'm going through it again, and it's been 12 years. And it's different also in the sense that this is much more ground intensive than when I was in the campaign, where I feel that air power won the war.
Are there any particular memories that have been surfacing a lot watching this new war?
I think watching the initial airstrikes over Baghdad at night and seeing the AAA rise above the city, there were a number of times where I flew in the middle of the night. In fact, 27 of the 30 missions I flew were at night. So I can vividly recall the AAA coming up at me and exploding, and also the trips that I flew to Baghdad. I remember those very well also.
What is the AAA?
AAA is anti-aircraft artillery, and ground forces on the ground will generally fire that. They could lock you up with their radar, or they can just fire it optically. And in many cases, you see the snake-like tracers going up into the sky, and that's what the AAA is.
Can you describe what it's like to be in the cockpit when anti-aircraft artillery is being fired at you? What do you see? What does it feel like physically?
The first two missions I flew to Baghdad, I was probably more terrified than I've ever been in my life. And flying up at 25,000 feet, ingressing to the target, and then as you get close to the city itself, you start to get tones and buzzes in your radar attack warning indicator that give you an impression that there's AAA sites or surface-to-air missile sites down below. And as you get closer, when they lock you up, you get a series of 7 beeps when they finally fire upon you. And ultimately, your objective is to get the good bombs on target. And as I was rolling in, there were missiles being fired at me, and I could see the black flat clouds of AAA exploding around me. And I can remember thinking it kind of reminds you of a John Wayne movie when you see the big black burst all around you. And you're absolutely terrified, but then for those 30 to 45 seconds that you're rolling in, you kind of lose sight of it all because you're concentrating so hard on putting your bombs on target. And once you pick all the bombs off and roll off, then all of a sudden it comes back again and you're scared again.
What can you do to evade or counteract the missiles or the anti-aircraft artillery that's directed at you?
We had pods on the aircraft that would help jam the radar sights on the ground. That's one way. We also have chaff, which is shredded bundles of aluminum that we could dispense from the aircraft. And there's also flares that will dispense from the aircraft to draw off a heat-seeking missile from you. The AAA itself, depending on the altitude that it's exploding at, sometimes it's luck. If you have a missile coming up at you, what you'll generally try to do is put that missile off of one wing or the other, and then as it's coming toward you, you want to kind of barrel roll around it to force it to overshoot and avoid being hit by the shrapnel or the warhead.
Can you hear the AAA or hear the heat-seeking missile as it's heading toward you?
Not at all, no. All you hear really is the constant hum of your engine. You're inside a cockpit, you have a helmet on, and there's nothing outside that you can hear. You can't hear bombs, you can't hear AAA, you can't hear missiles.
Does that make it even more eerie?
Not that it's eerie, it's more of a sense of being safe. And it's maybe sometimes a false sense of security because you feel safe in the cockpit, whereas you're very susceptible to being hit.
Are you alone in the cockpit?
Yes. The F-16 is a single-seat fighter.
And who are you in contact with?
Well, you have a formation. We always fly in at least a minimum of 2 aircraft in a formation. On the missions that we flew to Baghdad, the second mission I flew to bomb the nuclear research facility was the largest strike package of the war. We had 78 aircraft. And generally, you're talking with AWACS, the Airborne Warning and Control System controllers, and amongst yourselves within your formation.
That's a pretty big target, the nuclear research facility.
That was probably one of the most significant targets of the war. When we came in to brief that morning, our wing commander had told us that President Bush and many leaders around the world were going to be looking and paying attention to how we did that day. So it was a very important mission, and we went in. We took off and refueled, went up to Baghdad, dropped our bombs. I can remember having two guys shot down about 60 miles behind me and listening to them on the radios, or listening to one of them on the radios as he tried to escape to the south. It was very eye-watering, to say the least.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I had just come off target and lost sight of my wingman, and I was flying to the south trying to get away. I can remember there was a surface-to-air missile, what we called an SA-6, that was shot up toward me. And I looked down to my right, and I saw it coming up, and I was kind of slow, and you want to have airspeed to give you more maneuverability. And so I hit the emergency jettison button to punch off my wing tanks. And I kind of wanted to see what that looked like. So I banked to the left and looked back, and I can still close my eyes today and see those wing tanks tumbling toward the ground. And then I turned back to the right, and the missile went behind me. And so as I proceeded south and started to climb to gain altitude, all of a sudden one pilot was yelling on the radios. His call sign was Stroke 1, and he talked about being hit, and he'd lost his avionics system. And I would say for the next 20 minutes, he was basically just trying to get to the south and get as far away from Baghdad as possible. And all of us were just quiet. We were just listening. And eventually, he started to lose oil in his engine, and we just have one engine. And eventually that engine seized, and I can remember him saying, "I'm giving it my best Bogart up here." He was trying to be calm and cool. And eventually he said, "That's all I've got, guys." And he ejected, and that was the last we heard of him. He was captured as a POW and eventually returned home.
What does it do to your confidence as a pilot when someone who you know, someone you're flying with, gets shot down?
Well, it teaches you that you're not infallible, and it also gives you strength in the sense that, you know, when you can come back and make it back to the base and see most of your friends make it back, there's a real strong sense of camaraderie and unity within the group, and you pull together and you come together as a group, and that helps you.
The F-16 is equipped with night vision, so you can fly at night as if it were daytime, but you can't actually see your target.
Well, at the time of the Gulf War, you can roll in on a target, and you could program it to either appear as white hot or black hot in the type of shade that you would see. So if you were going to roll in on a group of tanks, for example, the metal from the tanks would retain heat over the course of the day and would show up as black dots.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be how you would identify your target at night, with radar and then the forward-looking infrared system. The difference today, though, is many of the pilots will fly with night vision goggles. So the difference there is that when we flew, our window was what was in the head-up display, whereas today a pilot with the goggles can look around anywhere and see the same picture.
Is it unnerving when you're seeing, you know, something on your radar screen that's like a square or whatever, but you can't really visualize the target itself? Is it unnerving to drop the bomb on it, not having that visual reality? I mean, you're too high up, it's too dark. I mean, you know, there's things that you just can't see.
It's not unnerving in the sense that I wasn't nervous about it or worried. You don't see people die. When you drop your bombs from a higher altitude, you see little puffs of smoke down on the ground, and you don't get a sense that people down there may be dying from that. So there's a difference there. I learned to separate my emotions when I got inside the cockpit. Sure, on the ground, I could think about the people that are dying and the effect that I'm having on the war. But once the canopy closed, I was all business and took care of whatever I needed to do to make sure that I achieved the objectives of my mission.
And what about when you'd land after the mission? Could you allow yourself then to think about, to ask yourself if people died or if people who, you know, were people who weren't military, you know, people who were not targets, if they died? Or is that something that you can't really let yourself think about?
I started to reflect on it when I was leaving the target area and returning to base. I would climb up into the 30,000 foot range, put the autopilot on, and eat some granola bars and spend the next hour reflecting on the mission. And I wasn't upset or didn't feel bad, supposedly. You never question whether or not they're civilians versus military personnel. You do the job, and then you come back and land, and you sleep 12 hours because you're mentally and emotionally exhausted.
Was there a mission where you realized for the first time that your bombs had actually killed someone?
There was. We were flying at night, and I had targeted a vehicle on a highway, and I rolled in and dropped the bombs and saw the vehicle explode, and that was the first time I realized that, yes, I had indeed taken a life. And I wrote about this in the book because I wanted people to understand that these people were human beings too. And this person I talked about was basically a fuel truck driver who had probably wanted to do his job. He's trying to get some fuel so he can help out his tank division. And maybe some of the guys that night said to him, hey, we've got these invitation cards that they've been dropping, and we can defect and get out of this war. And he probably thought about it and decided not to, simply because he didn't want to, you know, have any retribution toward his family or maybe even toward himself. So he's out there in the middle of the desert at 3 o'clock in the morning driving this fuel truck. And at that time, I'm going through my briefing, getting ready to fly. And as he's thinking about his family, I'm flying and thinking about mine. And eventually I roll in, and maybe he's reminiscing of his childhood, just driving in the middle of the night, and then he's gone.
Did you think about that kind of thing a lot?
I did, more so on the ground sometimes, watching the news coverage, when you would see the news reporters talk about civilian damage and the collateral damage that was occurring. Sometimes you think about that, but again, you have to separate those emotions, and when the canopy closes, do the job at hand.
Were you ever flying a mission where you hit the wrong target, and you knew that people, that there were unintended victims, that there were civilians who died?
No, I never flew a mission like that. And I can tell the people that we did everything we could to avoid missions like that. And one perfect example was one night we were preparing a briefing, and one of the intelligence officers came in with some satellite photos of a park in an Iraqi neighborhood near Basra. And in this park, Saddam Hussein had put a bunch of tanks and armored personnel carriers, thinking that maybe since they were kind of in a civilian area that they would be safe. And they were far enough away from some neighborhoods that we thought we could drop on them and still take them out. And the commander in charge of the mission looked at the park that these vehicles were in and said, on this one right side of the park, it looks like there's some homes there, so nobody drop anywhere near that side, and we'll just take everything over on the left side of the park. So when we rolled in, we could specifically target that left side and avoid the collateral damage on the right, and we made a point of doing that.
You described a little earlier what it was like when you were flying and one of the other planes you were flying with was shot down, and the pilot was captured, taken prisoner of war. What kind of training were you given about how to prepare if you were shot down?
Well, after I graduated from pilot training, we are sent to a base up in Washington State where we go through survival training. And during survival training, you receive classroom lectures about becoming a prisoner of war. You're taught escape and evasion techniques, and you're also taught how to avoid giving certain amounts of information to your captors. Every one of us that has ever been in the military over the last 20 years is very familiar with the Vietnam War and the fact that we had a number of prisoners in what we used to call the Hanoi Hilton in Vietnam. And so there was the code of conduct, so to speak, was the Bible of how to act. And back then, it was very stringent on what type of information you can give. And it's more lenient now because every soldier, every human being has a breaking point. And I think in the Vietnam War, soldiers resisted to the point of torture, where today you don't have to do that. I think the American public is smart enough to realize when they see a prisoner of war on television saying something under duress that he doesn't like the United States or what we're doing, people are smart enough to realize that he's in a stressful situation and being forced to say that and to not believe it is propaganda.
Have the rules officially been changed about what you're supposed to do if you're tortured?
Well, you are allowed to give information, and there's ways of giving information without giving information. A lot of the other countries and the militaries really have no idea what the technology is or what you're doing. So you can make things up and talk about things and act as if you're giving information and really not be.
Was it ever difficult when you were under a lot of strain and when you hadn't gotten a lot of sleep to keep your mind focused on a mission?
I was never tired during my missions. We were well prepared and well rested. I would come back from a mission, as I had mentioned earlier, physically and emotionally and mentally exhausted, and I could sleep a good 12 hours. And so when I would come in the next day to brief, I was fully refreshed and ready to go.
And they'd let you sleep the 12 hours?
Yes.
What about go pills, which are basically speed? They're uppers to keep you awake and alert. You had to take those sometimes.
Well, the pills are basically 5 milligrams of dextrodrine.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time you're exposed to those pills are when you're going through the lead-in fighter training program. You're given classroom lectures on their effects. You're even given some pills to take over a weekend just to make sure that you don't have any adverse reactions.
Mm-hmm.
When I flew from the United States to the Middle East, I was in the F-16 by myself for 17 hours. And during that period, I took 7 of the pills, one every 2 hours over the course of the mission. And they're just enough to keep you alert, keep you awake, and make you feel a little bit more comfortable. And there are times when you need them. And they're a controlled substance. The flight surgeons will come in before a mission and pass them out. And if you don't take them, they're collected when you return back. So I think they're an important help for fighter pilots during long missions.
How does combat compare to what you thought it was going to be when you first enlisted?
Well, the first couple of combat missions you fly, I don't care if you're the best fighter pilot in the world, you're going to be scared.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can imagine being in a theater watching a scary movie, how every muscle in your body is tense, and then feeling that for 6 or 7 hours straight, that's how you feel. But after those first 2 or 3 missions, when you've experienced it, you've seen the missiles, you've seen the AAA, all of a sudden you think, okay, I can get through this now. I know what it is. It's more of a fear of the unknown in the beginning, but once you've experienced it, then you move forward and then your training and your skills take over.
You mentioned in your memoir that there were moments where you were very depressed or very anxious, and you actually asked yourself, did you make the right choice in becoming a fighter pilot? What triggered that kind of second-guessing?
When I graduated from F-16 training, my twin girls were only 4 months old, and my first assignment was a 1-year remote to Korea. Shortly after I returned from that assignment, I was in school for 8 weeks and then another course for 6 weeks, and then all of a sudden the invasion of Kuwait occurred and I was off again for 6 more months. So I missed almost 21 out of 24 months of my girl's life. And I thought during that time, here I am on the other side of the world, I don't know if I'll ever see these girls again or come home. And sure, you question whether or not you made the right decision, whether flying a fighter was the right thing. But I made that commitment when I took the oath to join the Air Force. And ultimately, I was proud to have served.
How much did you allow yourself to think about your family when you were fighting the war? I know some people think it leaves you too vulnerable to have your emotions be that exposed, to have your emotions that close to the surface.
Well, prior to the war, I felt that I was as best as a human being as I had ever been. Most people die, they may have a heart attack or a traffic accident, and they don't have an opportunity to say the things that they want to say to their family or their friends. For me, in the weeks and the months leading up to the war, I had that opportunity because I knew what I was facing. A couple of nights before the war started, I sat down in a trailer and spoke into a camera and made a tape for my wife and my girls and just talked about my life and what I had experienced and the happiness that I felt and the ease that I felt going into combat. So I was able to write the letters that I wanted to write to my family, to my friends, say the things I wanted to say to my wife and my children, and then when I was ready to go into battle, I was perfectly comfortable with whatever was going to happen.
What was the most difficult mission you flew during the Gulf War?
two nights before the war ended, I was flying a combat mission, and we took off in the middle of the night and proceeded across the Gulf, and the weather was solid clouds from 30,000 feet all the way down to 7,000 feet. So at nighttime, I rejoined on a KC-10 tanker and took on fuel in the weather at night, and then dropped down to fire a Maverick missile against an Iraqi tank just west of Kuwait City. And after I fired that missile, my wingman called me and asked me what my position was off of a particular steer point that we were navigating from. But he made a mistake and said the wrong steer point. And during that 20 to 30 second period of time, I was trying to correct my position for him, and I stopped flying the aircraft. And my training as a T-38 instructor kind of came into play, because the very first mission you fly with a new student is a supersonic mission. You take a student up, you accelerate, go supersonic, and you teach that student what the handling characteristics of the aircraft are like. So here I am flying in the middle of the night over Kuwait, and all of a sudden the noise in the cockpit is real loud because of the wind blast against the canopy, and I notice that the controls are real sensitive, and I suddenly realize I'm close to being supersonic, if not so already. I looked down at my attitude indicator, and I was 30 degrees nose low. I looked up at the head-up display, and I was going through 1,600 feet. And all I did was say, hold on, and I pulled back as hard as I could. I have no idea how close to the ground I bottomed out, but it was a very tense moment. And I got one more Maverick kill, and then on the way home, a part of me just wondered whether or not I was alive or not. And just for the experience of it, I was still shaking. That was probably the hardest mission.
What would have happened had you not successfully pulled back?
I wouldn't be here talking to you today. I would have hit the ground.
How many feet away from the ground were you?
Well, our floor that they didn't want us to go below was 5,000 feet. And when I was 30 degrees nose low and looked at the head-up display, I was descending through 1,600 feet. So I was within 2 to 3 seconds of hitting the ground.
Wow. And were you pretty calm through that?
Well, the moment I realized it, I just pulled as hard as I could on the stick to pull the nose out from the dive that I was in. I spent the next few minutes locking up one more tank and getting one more kill. But then when I had time after the mission to reflect on what had happened, I felt pretty lucky and fortunate.
So when you're in an F-16, you can't feel that your nose cone is down and that you're in imminent danger of crashing.
At nighttime, it's very easy to become what they call spatially disoriented. The horizon is not visible, and sometimes the stars in the sky blend in with small lights on the ground. So you may feel that you're in a 30-degree bank turn, whereas you might be inverted and upside down. So when you start to feel a sense of, you know, misperception in how you're flying, you have to get on the instrument gauges and believe them and then react accordingly.
Now, you use the word kill, that you did one more kill. And the language of war is very complicated. If you use the word kill, it sounds kind of crass, you know, like one more kill. On the other hand, if you use the euphemisms, then you're kind of not acknowledging what it is you're really doing. If you're dropping ordnance on the bridge instead of bombing the bridge, it's like masking what's really happening. Have you, as a writer, having written this memoir, have you thought a lot about the language of war and the language that you're most comfortable with?
What I wanted to do with this book was to put the reader in the cockpit with me. I wanted them to experience the war. I realize there's a lot of technical things that are involved with flying an F-16, so I tried to explain it in a way that the average person would understand. But to give you an example, when you're flying on the highway of death, imagine if you're driving down the highway, and from 30 miles away at 20,000 feet with my ground-moving target track radar, I could sweep, and anything that's moving on the ground puts out a little line on my multifunction display. I can put my crosshairs on that vehicle. We'll say for this example it's your car. I could lock it up, and now I have distance and range to your vehicle. I start to descend and continue toward you, and within about 15 miles, I'll call up the Maverick video, I can slew the Maverick coordinates and target tracking gates right over your vehicle and lock it up, and within sight of 8 miles, fire that Maverick, turn around and leave, and within about 20 seconds, your car will be gone. And that's the technicality side, the video game side of it, if you will. So I tried to put the reader in the cockpit with me so that they can experience that.
Since we're talking about the highway of death and your mission, first of all, let me ask you to refresh everybody's memory about what the highway of death was. And tell us how it looked to you from the air. What were you able to see?
There's a highway that leaves out of Kuwait City, and it goes west a short ways, and then it turns to the north, and it goes all the way to Baghdad, and I believe they refer to it now as Highway 80. During the Gulf War, we had kill boxes that were 30-square-mile areas, and this particular kill box was titled Alpha Gulf 6, and it included that highway from Kuwait City up north toward Basra. And during the last week of the war, many units were assigned that kill box, including the squadron that I was in, and we were given what we called 20 minutes of play time. And during that 20-minute period, myself and my wingman owned that kill box, and anything that moved into it, we had clearance to destroy. If you recall, the Iraqis were trying to leave Kuwait, and their armor was on that highway heading to the north. So when we would come in and drop down into the kill box itself, I would have two Maverick missiles, my wingman would have four canisters of cluster bombs, we'd make a couple passes each along that highway and destroy whatever we could. I can recall in my head-up display, in my forward-looking infrared display, seeing Iraqi tanks, armored personnel carriers. I can recall at one point even having locked up a Winnebago van, which I didn't fire on, but I did destroy some tanks and armored personnel carriers along the highway.
How did the highway of death look to you from the ground photos that you saw after you finished your mission?
Completely different than what you see in the air. A lot of carnage, destruction, a lot of death in the pictures. From the air, it's more, again, like a video game, so to speak. You have infrared pictures of tanks rolling along a highway that's black in your picture with sand next to it that's a lighter shade. And you have your weapons on board and your radar, and you're tracking these targets, you're locking them up, you're firing missiles. Then when you go back and you sit in the squadron or come home and you see pictures of the highway itself, it's hard to imagine that you and your friends caused so much damage.
Did it make you feel any different about the mission?
No. I knew that those soldiers had raped, killed, and pillaged people in the city of Kuwait City and in the country of Kuwait. And my wingman asked me one day when we were going to the squadron, you know, how do you feel tonight? We're going to go in and we're going to kill these people. And I said, well, right now there's probably a group of Iraqi soldiers that maybe just finished doing some destructive things to people. They're going to sit down and have dinner. And in a little while, they're going to get in their armored personnel carrier. And during this mission, you and I are going to fly up there, and I'm going to target them, and they're going to be dead tonight. And that's just the way the war works.
Any final thoughts you'd like to leave us with?
I think the American public should be confident in our military, in our men and women. And while I understand and appreciate and would fight for their right to protest peacefully, at the same time, I think they should get behind our troops, support them, whether they agree with the war or not, send letters to any servicemen. And I know for myself and my friends, that gave us the courage and the sense of purpose to really do well and achieve what we did in the past war. And I know that these soldiers would appreciate the same from their hometown friends.
You know, a lot of people who think that this war is misguided and shouldn't be fought feel that they really do support the troops and that they're very much behind the troops. And that's part of the reason why they're against the war, because they're afraid that some of the people who are fighting will be losing their lives for no good reason.
Well, I would say that freedom isn't free, and every generation is going to have to fight for it. And some of the freedoms that we have, our hope, I think, is that the people of Iraq can experience those same freedoms. And the fact that some of our soldiers will die for that speaks highly of what kind of country this is.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Keith Rosenkranz is the author of the memoir Vipers in the Storm, Diary of a Gulf War Fighter Pilot. The introduction is by Dick Cheney.